And welcome to episode 3 of Meeple Skills. This is our March 2019 episode, and we are the only podcast that has 6 dump stats. I am here with my co-host and lovely wife,
Jackie Lemmer.
And of course, I am Ethan Richardson. You may know me from the internet.
Today we are talking about don't delay, build your dungeon, army, or kingdom today! Because that totally tied together in my mind when I had the idea.
Well, the important thing is that it rhymed.
It did, and it rhymed so well!
Exactly. So, the games we're talking about today are Unstable Unicorns,
Boss Monster,
and
Disney's Villainous by Wonderforge.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one on the list there that I tried to scroll to, and my computer was a lame head. So, let's talk Unstable Unicorns. Why don't you tell us about that game, Jackie?
Okay. Well, Unstable Unicorns is really cool. This game doesn't exactly have a publisher. It was done on Kickstarter, and it was self-published, I guess you could say. T-Turtle picked it up, and they are currently the ones who are still producing it. It can be picked up, of course, on Amazon and most retailers, such as Target. It is a game for 2 to 8 players. It's a card game. The objective is to collect the best unicorns the fastest. And I guess technically you don't have to collect the best unicorns. You just have to get 6 or 7 unicorns total. I just figured that you might as well collect the best ones because then you can win with more flair.
Betterly.
Betterly. You can win betterly.
Right.
So the turns work in 4 phases. You have your beginning phase, which is literally just checking what is in your board state to see if you have anything with triggers. Then your draw phase, where you draw a card. Your action phase, where you actually have 2 options. You can either play a card or you can draw another card if you don't have anything in your hand that you want to play at that time. And then your end of turn is just checking your hand to make sure that you have 7 cards. And if you have more than 7 cards, you have to discard a couple of them. And then the setup for this game is super easy. You shuffle the cards except for the white cards. There's white cards and black-backed cards. And the white cards stay in their own pile because that's the nursery pile. And that's where all your cute little baby unicorns are.
Oh my god, they're so cute. It's disgusting.
So adorable!
I'm still sickened.
They are. And the baby unicorns don't really do anything special. They're just really cute.
But they do count towards your unicorn total.
They do. They do count towards the unicorn total. And then you'll have a pile for the regular draw deck. And then each player gets a certain amount of cards, which I believe is 5 to start with. Also start with 1 baby unicorn automatically. So the baby unicorn will sit on the table right in front of you. As you play, you will play new unicorns to the right or the left of your baby unicorn. So you'll make a nice little line of unicorns. And then you'll actually play upgrade or downgrade cards directly below the unicorn. The upgrade and downgrade cards do have to be attached to a unicorn, and that is partially so that other people can help try to get rid of those as the game goes on. The win condition is the first person to 6 or 7 unicorns, and it just depends how many players you have, whether or not you're trying to get to 6 or 7. If you have less than 4 people, you want 7. If you have more than 4 people, you're going to need 6 unicorns.
Otherwise, the game lasts forever.
Yeah, the game we'll go on for quite a bit of time.
We'll tell that story when we're done. Continue.
Anyway. So the cards for this game are absolutely hysterical. The basic unicorns have flavor text underneath them that show just how basic they are. Like, popped collars are for date nights only. And it's a unicorn with a polo and he's got his collar popped. He's so cute. And then some of the magical unicorns that are available. They have abilities, and one of them is called the Annoying Flying Unicorn, and it's got like one of those like squeaky horns on its horn, and it's like clashing cymbals and like obviously being a pain in the butt. I think that's my spirit unicorn.
That's probably accurate.
It's so cute. There's a kitten corn, so it's actually a rainbow kitten with a little unicorn horn on it. There's Stabby the Unicorn, who has a glass shard literally, like, taped to his horn. There's the extremely fertile unicorn, which is this kind of irritated looking unicorn that has like six baby unicorns around it, and its horn is surprisingly long. And then some of the other fun cards is Pandemonium, which is a downgrade card that you can play on somebody else, and it turns all your unicorns into pandas.
Which are very cute, but don't win you the game.
No, because you can't win if they're pandas. You can only win with unicorns. And so to backtrack on this a little bit, there's actually seven different types of cards. There's magic cards, instant cards, upgrade, downgrade, magical unicorn, basic unicorn, and baby unicorn. The magical, basic, and the babies are the ones that count towards your total. And the narwhals that are in there also count, because narwhals are obviously water unicorns.
Unicorns of the sea.
Exactly.
That's what they were called in the 1880s by Ernest Hemingway.
I'm not sure that's true.
It's not.
Don't be giving false facts.
It's not a false fact. It's a straight out lie.
One of the things I liked about this game is that it plays a lot like a simplified version of Magic the Gathering, because there is actually a stack, but you can only play one card at a time and you don't have to worry about mana, so you cut out a lot of the complicated parts of Magic. What were your impressions, Ethan?
Well, I had a ton of fun. So, story time. When we played Unstable Unicorns, the first time we played it, we brought it out with my family. Now, here's just to give you an idea of how fun this game actually is most of my family was not in the mood to play at all. But, you know, they humored us and began playing anyway. And by the first couple of turns, they were all hooked. Like, my brother, who was probably the most resistant to playing, started creating stories for all of his unicorns on the table. And he's like, all right, and he'd play a card. I'm like, this one's girlfriend, and like stuff like that. And my father ended up winning, even though we got the rules a little bit wrong. We thought that we had to go to seven unicorns, but because of the amount of players we had, we only had to go to six. And then we realized that my dad had won turns and turns and turns ago. And I believe that was the game I got pandemoniumed in, so I had no chance of winning. Unless I could get rid of it, which I did not before we realized Dad had actually won. So, the funniest part about that is, my dad is, unfortunately unable to talk completely. So interacting, within the game was actually kind of fun to see him get excited about stuff, because you'd see it on his face and he wouldn't be able to communicate it, but then he'd play the card that would do something ridiculous to one of us, and then we all just, you know, had to take it. But no, it was a blast to play. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Definitely something you break out with the friends or family, and just some of the art and subtle humor in some of those cards just cracked me up.
It's really great that way. So on the like it scale, I gave it an 8. The art is great. It plays very smoothly. I really liked it. The downsides to it was that even if you're only going towards six unicorns, like you properly should, the game can still drag on a little bit, especially there at the end. I don't know why, and maybe I'm doing something wrong, but it just drags just a bit. But I also put it on the risk level for the faux scale.
The risk level?
I have put it at the risk level.
I disagree, but tell me why.
I put it at the risk level because it is so easy to derail your opponents, and it is so easy to, like, really mess up the game. So the downgrade cards, like Pandemonium, if we had been correct in having to go to seven unicorns, Ethan would have won the game a long time ago, but I stuck Pandemonium on him. And so even though he had like 8 or 9 unicorns, he couldn't win because they were technically pandas. There are cards in there that will get rid of downgrade cards or cards that could have gotten rid of the unicorn that it was attached to, but he didn't draw any of them. And of course, nobody else was willing to help him out. And so there definitely was like an element of creating alliances, like, oh, we can knock this person out of the game, or oh, we can prevent this person from winning this turn, and then maybe I can win next turn. So it does definitely create that backstabbing feel to it, which is, happens a lot in Risk. But, I mean, you just don't notice it as much because it is so cute and funny.
Yeah, it's a goofy game. And see, I sort of, I would put it probably about a 7 or 8 on the Like It scale too, but as far as the friend or foe, I think that it actually, the fact that it is so easy to derail your opponents actually lowers it, because it makes it more friendly because everybody has an opportunity to screw everybody else over. There's no particular strategy that works super well, and that if you know the strategy, you can just, you know, steamroll everybody, which is really when I think games like Risk make people feel like they might not be having fun and be mad. And similar to like games of Magic, you know, where you don't draw any of the cards you need ever and then you just lose, it didn't quite feel that way. I think just because the number of players and the attention isn't focused on one individual for most of the game, is kind of why it feels that way. And then as far as the length of the game, like you were saying, I think that depends greatly on the number of players and how long it takes somebody to get ahead and how far ahead they get. Because there was a good portion of that game we played where my dad was very far ahead, and then each of us would spend the subsequent turns trying to push him back.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than advancing our own strategy, we were trying to push him back so we could catch up. And so I think that's the kind of things that lets the game go on a little bit longer.
And that's very true. But there are some ridiculous combos in this game, too. Like the Extremely Fertile Unicorn allows you to get a baby unicorn at the beginning of every one of your turns. And then there's other cards that allow you to that trigger on certain events. So you could have at least two or three cards that go off in one turn, allowing you to get two or three unicorns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had something I remember where, like, basically at the beginning of my turn, if they hadn't been all pandas, I could have done something to let me get, like, a unicorn or another ability out of a discard pile to do something else to interact with one of my unicorns to get another unicorn, and that's what would have won me the game. They were all pandas!
You seem a little angry about that.
No, not really.
So that was Unstable Unicorns. Highly recommend it. There, as we mentioned, there's a lot of different ways to interrupt play. Very interactive. A very good game to play with your friends or family because it is pretty easy to learn, pretty easy to set up. It's also in a small box, so it's easy to travel. There are some expansions available for this one. There is a Not Safe for Work expansion. Maybe not as good for the family part of my recommendation. There's a Dragons pack, a Rainbow Apocalypse pack, and a Unicorns of Legend pack. And those are added just into the main deck, so it just makes it bigger each time you add an expansion. Next on our list is Boss Monster by Brotherwise Games. And part of the reason I thought these were on the same level is because Unstable Unicorns is your army builder, and now we're building your dungeon. Boss Monster, as I mentioned before, is created by Brotherwise Games. It is for 2 to 4 players. The objective of the game is to build the most badass dungeon. The turns work in 5 phases. The beginning of the turn, you draw a room card and reveal heroes equal to the number of players. The heroes will be in a different pile. And then you have your build phase, where you actually select which one of the room cards in your hand you're going to build, and you place these face down next to your monster. And then there's the actual build phase, where you flip it over. And then you have the bait phase, where you attract the heroes to your dungeon. Any of the little symbols that are in the lower left,
right,
as Ethan said, on the right-hand side of the card, if they match a hero, that hero comes to your dungeon, and they try to defeat the dungeon and your monster. They go through, and if they make it through the dungeon, then you get a wound, and if you are managed to kill the hero in your dungeon, then you get a soul. First person to set 10 souls wins, And if you end up with 5 wounds, you are automatically eliminated from the game. So instead of a dungeon crawler, this is a dungeon builder. Unstable Unicorns and Boss Monster kind of have a similar feel because they are games where you collect cards from a main deck and then you have a line of cards directly in front of you. In Unstable Unicorns, you play the upgrades or downgrades directly below your line of your army of unicorns, whereas in Boss Monster, you can play upgrades and downgrades directly on the rooms themselves. So you can change them every turn if you want, because you have a maximum of 5 rooms. So if you know that there are some heroes that got left in town, and that's what it's called when nobody was able to attract the heroes, they just stay there and then you'll draw 2 more on the next turn. So you might know that there's like these 2 heroes that are going to be there for sure. So you could build rooms to specifically get one of those 2 heroes or both. There's also spell cards in this game, and the spell cards can be used to either make you more competitive or to slow down one of your opponents. Once again, it's one of those games where you're trying to find a nice synergy. There are different kinds of rooms. There's monster rooms and trap rooms. And if you can get all of one kind of room, which is really hard to do, a lot of times they'll synergize with each other and make the dungeon even more deadly for the poor heroes that are just trying to prove themselves in your dungeon. So, Ethan, what were your impressions of this game?
Well, we've played it a few times. It's been out for a few years, and I kind of enjoy it. We've only gotten to play it a few times as like a larger multiplayer game. And honestly, like, it works really well as a 2-player game, but it's very different dynamic. Because one thing I've noticed, when you only have 2 players, you actually don't go through your spell cards as quickly. And so there's less shenanigans that can happen in the game. You're more focused on, just building your own dungeon the best that you can, trying to make sure it has a variety of symbols so you can attract the heroes. Since you're only competing against one person, you can keep track a little easier of, you know, how many symbols of each and try and spread it out a little bit. And really, you just focus on making the rooms with the most damage possible rather than screwing with your opponent. And because some have, like, some of the rooms with their abilities to, like, destroy any room in any dungeon or something like that, you want to build those rooms so you can stop your opponents from doing well. But in the 2-player, it's just basically who can build the best rooms fastest. But, both modes are fun to play overall, and it's something that, especially as someone who's grown up around video games and the theme of the game with its, 16-bit art and kind of a lot of references to older video games and, D&D and all these other kinds of classics that we think of when you have a boss monster. Just kind of make it fun, almost nostalgic, even though it's a new concept from a game's perspective. So I like it overall.
Yeah. I ranked it a 7 on the like it scale and a Monopoly on the foe scale. It's a 7 on the like it scale because I do really enjoy it, but like Ethan said, as a 2-player, it just doesn't have quite the randomness. It is a lot of fun. You still build your dungeon, but the spell cards don't come out as much, and that's partially because you don't necessarily draw new spell cards on each turn. You only draw spell cards if you have something that tells you to do so. So if you build a certain room that allows you to draw a spell card each turn, then you'll get them. But those are also less likely to come out if you've only got 2 people versus 3 or 4. So in a 3-to-4 person game, there's a lot more shenanigans happening, a lot more rooms being destroyed, a lot more heroes getting buffed so that they can get through the dungeon faster. So those are a lot of things think about, and that's part of the reason why it was a 7 and not an 8 for me, is that I wish there was something that had been added to the 2-player version of the game, like a 2-player variant that would allow you to get to the spell cards a little faster. Or even something to dig through even the room deck so that you could kind of pick your card a little better. There's quite a few cards that let you pick through the discard, but nothing that really lets you pick through the deck.
Yeah, now that you say that, I never really noticed that. But yeah, there's not a whole lot that lets you kind of search for particular things, which is probably honestly for the better, because the room deck is pretty big.
It is.
So I feel like that would actually just kind of drag the game down.
It would slow it down considerably. And then it's a monopoly on the foe scale, because there is that ability to take people down. People have this beautiful dungeon built, and they think they're going to be able to get three of the heroes, and they're going to be able to turn those heroes into souls. And then as the hero's going through, you can buff that hero. Now all of a sudden, they're too powerful. Or you can destroy someone else's room, and now they have one less room, so they've only got four rooms to clear instead of five, which could have been the difference between that hero dying and that hero making it. So that is a lot of differences. Also, each person's monster is different, and your monsters have different abilities. And once you hit the five rooms, their ability takes action. And so their ability might be kind of underwhelming for your situation, because there are some that it's just like, okay, well, I leveled up. That's a thing, and it doesn't really do much for it. But then there's like the Lich and King Kroger, where they actually, I can't remember right now exactly what it is they do, but they have an ability that is actually useful.
Yeah, I've noticed, especially in the two-player games, your level up ability that I've had doesn't really do a whole lot. Or like, they'll do one thing once, and then it's over. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yep.
Neat. And then you move on and the game continues as if nothing happened.
So it's more of like a little boost, really, than a level up.
Yeah. I concur.
Yes. So Boss Monster has many expansions that I have not been able to play yet, but there's Boss Monster 2, The Next Level, Rise of the Mini Bosses, which is actually one that came out at Gen Con last year, Tools of Hero Kind, Implements of Destruction, and Crash Landing. The last three that I mentioned there, the Tools of Hero Kind, Implements of Destruction, and Crash Landing, they're more like booster expansions. You're going to want to just put those into one of the other games. Boss Monster 2 and the Attack of the Mini-Bosses can actually be played as standalone games, or they can be combined with each other. So you can skip expansions, you don't have to collect this one in order, which makes it really cool.
Yeah.
Which leads us to our final game.
Can I talk about this one? Because I actually like this one.
Yes, you sure can.
All right, so if you are listening and you haven't quite caught on, I'm more or less, I rate a lot of board games the same, about average. But this one I actually have really enjoyed playing because it has so many different ways to play that kind of can speak to any mood you're in or any play style that you prefer more than any other. So I'm talking about Villainous by Wonderforge Games. It's a game for 2 to 6 players, and the objective is to defeat the heroes of your story. It's all based on Disney villains, so there are several villains you can choose to play from. You can choose Maleficent from Sleeping Beauty.
Yep.
All right. I don't know my Disney very well either, but I still like this game a lot. Ursula from Little Mermaid, Jafar from Aladdin, Prince John from Robin Hood, Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland, and Captain Hook from Peter Pan. Each villain comes with their own oversized little mover thing that you keep track of the board. It's just such an interesting dynamic because each of these villains, like when you pick your character, they come with a deck of cards that works completely differently for each character. So I love playing as Jafar because he's a very kind of combo deck sort of thing. So like his, and then each villain has a goal. So Jafar's goal is to get the lamp to the palace and have the genie under his control. Which, of course, apparently is not how the movie went. And isn't going to go in the next one. So now I already know what happens. I don't even think I'm going to see this Will Smith one. I don't know. A lot of what Jafar's deck can do is search your discard pile for particular pieces, so you can keep kind of going back and forth and making sure you get all your pieces, discarding cards you don't need, and then getting them back later. And I love that style of play in other games. And it's made it so I win this one a lot.
Yeah, he does win this one a lot.
So in the middle of the table, you have this rock cauldron. It's full of these little tokens, which are the power tokens. And each player has a board that represents their villain in their story, the villain marker, their deck, and a fate and hero deck. And then in a larger game, there's also a fate token to help track which player is the last one to be fated. But being fated is basically the best way for your opponents to mess with you. So you have different allies in your deck. You have items and abilities that you can do in your deck of cards. And one of the abilities you have sometimes is to fate your opponents. When you do that, you take two cards from their fate deck.
Yes, and then
choose
you pick
one of them, and you assign it to one of the spaces on their board. And each space on the board represents a different location in the story or the movie. And once you've done that, they then have to defeat that hero in order to access all of the abilities you get on that space. And that's significant because each space has different abilities you can do for your turn out of all of the actions. You can only do whatever space you're on as your villain. So, it does sort of have a similar feel to Boss Monsters. You're playing the villain, and you kind of have this dungeon and your minions doing the work for you, but also kind of has that unstable unicorns feel where you're trying to arrange a particular set of cards in a certain way and achieve a certain goal in order to win the game. Jackie, why don't you tell me how you feel about Villainous?
Well, I really, really like this game. It is so unique. I have not found anything quite like it. It's because of the way the player boards work, you know, you definitely are very focused on what's happening right in front of you, while also thinking about what the other people are doing, but most of your actions are going to come from right in front of you. And it's so weird because you have to move each turn. You can't just leave your marker on the same one and perform the same actions each time. So you do have to move. And that can sometimes cause problems. I have tried to play as Maleficent many, many times, and I haven't been able to win as her because one of the things that she has to do to win is she has to curse each section, but several of the curses make it so that she can't go back to that section, or if she does, that curse goes away, so then you have to recurse it. So you're actually cutting yourself off from a lot of your board. Which definitely adds a level of difficulty to it. And also the curses seem to be really easy to remove. So anytime somebody throws a hero in that, it really derails you. Whereas I have also played as Prince John, not against Ethan, but against some other friends. And that card deck is so aggro, because for that one, what you're trying to do is just get enough power tokens to win. And it works really fast, and nobody else that was playing figured out what I was doing or what Prince John needed to win. So I was within 2 power tokens of winning before they're like, oh, you're going to win on the next turn.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing with Jafar, too, because the way that deck works is it's so, like, you know, trying to put your pieces in the right spot. You're a mastermind planning behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. If your opponent didn't pay attention to exactly how that works, mm-hmm. you can just kind of come back from middle of nowhere and just be like, okay, now I win.
Yeah.
You know, if you just get the right cards in the right order, you just move to the space, get your genie, hypnotize the genie, bring it back, you know, bring the lamp back, and you're done.
Yeah. And it is so easy to lose track of what the other players are doing because you're working towards your own goal. And it is so cool how you work towards your own goal and how each villain definitely has a flavor that is very true to the Disney lore.
Very cool. So where do you put it on the like it scale?
I put this one at a 9 on the like it scale because I just love it so much. And my only critique, and this is an incredibly picky critique of the game, is that since the only thing you can do to interact with the other players is to fate them, it just kind of makes it so you are so focused on yourself. And there's not a whole lot of that player interaction. Now, I will say, as Prince John, I noticed that there was a lot more. Because since all I was doing was trying to work on getting power tokens, I had a lot of turns where I could fate other people. And I think one of the locations allows you to fate 2 people. So I was fating people while I was collecting all of my power. So that was the most I'd ever really interacted with the other people. Because as Maleficent, I was working so hard to get those curses. And then all of a sudden, Ethan's like, well, I'm done. It's like, oh, dang it.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of one of the reasons I'm able to get away with it, too, is because when you're playing as Jafar, you know, most of what I'm doing is so focused on my board, I'm, like, rarely fading people unless I absolutely have to. And then they're like, oh, he's not doing anything. I don't have to worry about him. And then I move the lamp over and hypnotize the genie and I win.
Mm-hmm. We played it once incorrectly where we thought you were supposed to fate at the end of every turn.
Oh, that was hard.
That got insane. So
that game was like 6 hours long and nobody won. And we stopped because we were hungry.
Basically. So there's a good reason that you can only fate when you land on certain levels. I just kind of wish, I feel like there needs to be something in between. Like, you can't quite fate on every turn, but I feel like there needs to be just something that allows a little bit more interaction.
That's, I don't know, personal. I like winning, though.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I think it's fine how it is. Yeah, I'd say a 9 is actually, that's really high for me, and I actually enjoy this game pretty well. So, on the foe scale,
I put it at an uno on the foe scale, mostly because of that lack of interaction. Just, it's a little harder to derail their strategy. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but because it's Disney, I just don't feel as upset when people fate me, because I'm like, oh, here's the heroes! Oh, wait.
Right, I don't want that. Crap! I'd say that's pretty accurate. I think that, because the fate and hero cards aren't game-breaking in that, you know, there's no single card in anyone's hero deck that's going to absolutely stop them from doing what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. You can hold them back, you can pause them for a turn, and it's very easy then for that person to just get rid of that card through the combat mechanic, and then move on with their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, especially like Jafar's board doesn't have a lot of fate spaces. So, and that's kind of his drawback, is I can't mess with a lot of people, but I can very easily get my combo together. When you move to that fate one, so it's very important that both of those things I get are good, so I can choose just the best one when I'm fading somebody. Because I'm not likely going to be able to do it again the next turn. So I think, like I said, none of the heroes absolutely stop Jafar or whichever villain you're playing from doing their plan. You just have to come up with a more creative way to get around it.
I think that's a very good point. So there is a new expansion to Villainous, and it is Villainous Wicked to the Core, and it just came out on March 3rd. And it is including Hades, the Evil Queen from Snow White, and Dr. Facilier from Princess and the Frog. I am so excited to get to try this expansion, especially Hades. Hades is one of my favorite villains anyway, and apparently part of his deck and how it works is you have to get all of the Titans out and to mount Olympus. It was like, oh, that just sounds so cool.
I freaking loved that movie when I was a kid, so I dibs on Hades, actually.
Dang it!
Just kidding.
But yeah, I can't remember. I know that Dr. Facilier is actually going to have kind of a similar feel to Jafar, so you might like that one a lot, because it's going to be one where he's working with prophecies, and you're having to dig through your deck and find the right things and get the things into the right places. Snow White, I believe you have to get the apple to Snow White.
That's easy. That happens in the beginning.
That happens at the end of the movie.
What?
Because she's running away from the queen, and that's how she ends up shacking up with the dwarves. And
I never watched that one.
I figured.
Okay. I thought that was the whole point, is she eats the apple and falls asleep.
Yeah, that's at the end. There's like this whole buildup of like characterization, except for, you know, it was long enough ago that she, as a princess, doesn't really get much of a character other than she's pretty and kind. And then the dwarves get all their songs and singing, and they talk to animals and do their mining thing. It's mostly to characterize the dwarves so that you feel more sorry for them losing Snow White before the prince comes and kisses her and wakes her up.
I hate Disney.
That one, you can just blame like fairy tales in general. And actually the original fairy tale is so much creepier.
Yeah, I like those.
She was like 12 in the fairy tale. Well, not that part.
God.
It's so weird.
Come on. All right, we're done with games now. That's it.
This is the Role-Playing Game Corner.
Today on RPG Corner, we're going to be talking about Strongholds and Followers, a 5th edition supplemental product put out by MCDM Productions. Any of you role-playing game folks who spend a lot of time on YouTube, or maybe a little of time on YouTube, might be familiar with Matt Colville, who's done a Running the Game series on YouTube, and now has began streaming one of his Dungeons & Dragons games that he does for some of his friends down there in the Californias. So overall, it was written and designed by Matt Colville. It includes an adventure called The Siege of Castle Rend, written by James Hake, I think is how it's pronounced. I'm not 100% sure, honestly. Who I believe works for D&D Beyond as a writer as well. But he's written a lot of good adventures, and has worked with Wizards of the Coast on some adventures as well. So I'd like to think he knows what he's doing. I have not gotten a chance to run this adventure yet, but it is very promising in its setup and everything. And it kind of leads the party into the contents of Strongholds and Followers. So as a little bit of an introduction, Strongholds and Followers is actually something that goes way back to some of the original parts of Dungeons & Dragons. So in a lot of the original D&D games, even run by Gary Gygax and his friends, it was kind of understood that by a certain level, you would be well known enough that you would start to attract followers, and some of your rewards, rather than just piles of gold, might be a castle or a home base of sorts. And it became the sort of understood part of the game where, and now in 5th edition, the rules for that don't exist. In AD&D, in the first editions of D&D, there were literally rules in a rule book somewhere that explained, yes, you get this follower at this level, and they can do this ability. And so Matt Colville, who really enjoyed that kind of aspect, and I think a lot of players in 5th edition currently enjoy that aspect, whether or not they are kind of aware that it's an understood part of the history of D&D. So the book itself, it's massive. It's almost 300 pages of just straight rules explaining how the different types of strongholds and followers work, plus the adventure, which covers about 50 pages, and then appendices including new monsters, rules for warfare, which is also something that's not outlined in the 5th edition rules as it is, including an even simplified version of those rules, and then some new magical items as well. The general gist of the sections, it talks about how you build your stronghold, what other kind of features it can have, and it even has different types of strongholds built out for every single class in the base game. So you can have the Barbarian Camp, the Bard's Theater, the Cleric's Church, the Druid's Grove, the Fighter's Fortress, the Monk's Monastery, the Paladin's Chapel, the Ranger's Lodge, the Rogue's Tavern, the Sorcerer's Sanctum, the Warlock's Fane, and the Wizard's Library. And it even includes rules for villain strongholds and how you can build that out to give your party something to adventure into and perhaps even take over. Which kind of goes into the adventure, The Siege of Castle Rend, where I believe that exact thing happens. You go and siege the castle and take it over for yourself. The followers portion of the book, while it doesn't take up quite as much space, is still very much nice supplemental rules you can add to your game, including units that your party may manage, artisans, retainers, ambassadors that might reach out. If you have a party of adventurers based out of a castle near a large kingdom, they might, you know, the king of that kingdom's probably going to want to keep an eye on that and have ambassadors to make sure this random bunch of mercenaries with a castle isn't just going to come in and kill their villagers. So the book itself was on Kickstarter, funded in like 20 seconds. I don't know. It was crazy. Oversold. You can get it as PDF. I think you can still get it as hardcover. And is continuously updated if you get the PDF. So I believe if you kickstarted it, you get the PDF and the hardcover. And anytime they make any changes, because they still like to fine tune, and then when some word gets back that something didn't quite work the way they planned, even though they had like, you know, 3,000 people playtest this thing, they like to make sure they go back and fix some of those things so they work as they're intended rather than, you know, any mistakes that were made. And there's all kinds of just random cool stuff hidden throughout this book. So I definitely recommend checking it out. There's just a lot of good stuff in it. Like this whole, the whole idea of just managing a stronghold in this kingdom, like that really speaks to the civilization player in me of managing resources and individuals. So if you're into that kind of stuff and you like to play those micromanage-y, kind of resource-driven games, or just want to give your players something to go back to, a home base of sorts, definitely check this book out. It's great.
The Kickstarter highlight. And I just wanted to mention, first off, that Over Battle, the All War, will be launching on March 19th. Don't forget to go check that out on Kickstarter and back it. It is going to be an amazing game, and I can't wait till it's actually in production and in my home.
Let's not forget that if you're interested in Over Battle, the All War, you can check out episode 2 in our February episode of Meeple Skills, where we interviewed Rob McBride, the designer and creator of Over Battle the All War.
Definitely. And currently on Kickstarter, we have Root, the Underworld expansion. Now, Root is a game that was kickstarted in 2018, and I believe it was either released or released very close to Gen Con time. All I remember is that it sold out, like, in minutes at Gen Con. It looks really great. I haven't gotten a chance to play it yet, but it is kind of a war-type game, a war resource management style game that is very unique, partially because the art in it is absolutely adorable. You're playing as these cute little birds and kitties and raccoons, and I think there's mice and foxes, and it is just super adorable. The art is great, and yet it is considered an asymmetrical strategy game. And part of that is because each character you play as works completely differently. A lot like Villainous with all of its different characters and how in order to win you have to leverage their goals and their abilities. Very similar to that, except for you do have a central game board and there is a battle aspect, so you're interacting directly with the other woodland creatures and the other players. There's a lot of management in it between crafting, battling, taking over. And then some of the characters even have secret goals that they have that none of the other characters have to deal with. And so they have to reach their secret goals in order to win. And then the person who wins is just whoever gets to 30 victory points the fastest. So now, on Kickstarter, the Underworld expansion is available. This one offers new factions to play as, includes a new map, new insurgent faction. And it also has what they're calling the Complete Law of Root, which is a new rule book that encompasses every existing product in the Root world. It'll be on Kickstarter for about another 2 weeks, so log on. It has already been fully funded, but if you would like to get the original Root and all of the expansions, or if you just need to add this expansion to your repertoire, go ahead and head over to Kickstarter.
Two main reasons I'm going to talk at this part. First of all, April's my birthday month. Send me money. Secondly, Jackie doesn't really care about this, but April, we're getting new Game of Thrones. We're getting the final season of Game of Thrones, and I am just not ready as a human being with a soul to let that go. So we're doing an all Game of Thrones episode. We're going to do Game of Thrones board games, Game of Thrones the RPG. We're going to do just Game of Thrones here and there, Game of Thrones everywhere. It's going to be lit. So we're going to be talking about a Game of Thrones, the board game, second edition. We're going to do a Game of Thrones Settlers of Catan and a Song of Ice and Fire miniatures game, which I believe was released last year, was kickstarted, looks awesome. I can't wait to play it. Also, it's my birthday. And then we're going to cover A Song of Ice and Fire by Green Run and Publishing, the RPG set in the Game of Thrones universe. And also, it's my birthday month. Okay, well, that does it for our March episode of Meeple Skills. You can follow the podcast on Twitter, at Meeple Skills Pod. You can follow Jackie
on Twitter, at Jackie Limmer.
Jackie_Limmer.
You can also follow us on the Instagram with our Meeple Skills Instagram. It has many pictures of board games.
What else? You can follow me individually on Twitter, at NerdMeat. Follow me on Twitch, twitch.tv/NerdMeat, where I play all kinds of games. And don't forget to check out project-nerd.com for all your nerdy news needs. And also Project-Nerd is on Patreon, so go ahead and throw some money that way so you can hear more Wunderbar podcasts such as this one and many other ones like The Nerdcast. What is that? Sexy Nerd Science. Let's see what else. The Radults. And all kinds of other great podcasts.
There's
more
a newer one. There's a newer one called The G-Spot, which is supposed to be G for geek.
Oh.
I thought that was funny too.
Yeah. Well, I hope you can find that one. I'm gonna edit in a rim shot here.
That's horrible.
Isn't it? Thank you for joining us. We will see you next month. Holla at ya.
Bye.